I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, welcome along to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine. This week we're chatting to Caroline Dunford, an author who is prolific. She's published over 30 books, spanning all genres, wartime mysteries, romance, YA. We talk about how, with so many ideas floating about, how does she decide what she's writing next? Also, you can hear how she plans a year to write 3 books in it. And, after writing so many books, what has she learned about what her stories need to be in the future?
It's made me realise that the only things I will write are stories where I am totally in love with the characters and where I really want to be in that journey with them. I mean, if I could, I would step into that book and be doing whatever they're doing alongside them. I used to get touches of that earlier on in stories where there were bits where I really felt immersed. But now I recognize that feeling of excitement and the feeling that several hours will go by and it'll be like 10 minutes. I've just been writing away.
There is more with Caroline Dunford in this week's Writer's Routine. Welcome along. My name is Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine. I'm very thankful that you are there. It's the show where we take a route through an author's working day. We see how, when, and where they get to work. There's a lot of why in there too. This week's episode is brought to you by the new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? Now, if you love writing, which I think you do, if you love storytelling, I reckon you probably do, if you love podcasts, well, I hope you do, then you will really enjoy this. It's right up your street. Who is the Cheese Wire Killer is all about a murder back in 1983. Unsolved. It's regarded as one of Scotland's most gruesome unsolved murders. And across 5 episodes, told through a mixture of documentary and drama, this series goes into the very centre of a live investigation. It's going on right now, and you can be part of it. It's a classic whodunit case that has baffled the police for over 40 years. The killer is still on the run. A few months ago, the police announced the biggest step forward in this case. There is interviews with so many key players, with a senior investigating officer, with forensic scientists, with psychologists, as well as family members and friends of the victim too. So if you really enjoy your true crime podcasts, they're a huge hit, and you want a different take on it, a twist on the genre, well, this is something that's never really been done before. You are part of a live investigation. Try and uncover the secret. Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? You can find the series now. Search wherever you get your shows and try to solve one of the most famous murders ever. It's a really good chat for you this week. It's almost philosophical, talking about the big picture of writing. How brilliant and exhilarating and compulsive it is, but also how tough it can be too. Our guest is Caroline Dunford. She's published over 30 books. Her best loved is the Euphemia Martins mysteries, murder stories that happened over 100 years ago. She's also published across genres. Her newest release is YA. It's called The Augmenters, which she's published as Gemini Gibson. Caroline teaches writing too, and we really do get into it. You can hear why she has a storytelling infection, why she needs it to make sense of the world, but also to the point where writing all the time doesn't give her burnout. but saves her from it. Also, we run through why sometimes she's writing under contract and other times out of it, those times when a story needs to be told. You can hear about whether plot development changes in a series of many books. Like when you've written 17 stories with characters, do you get into a rhythm of knowing what is more or less likely to happen? Does anything still take you by surprise? And there is the truth about the realities of being an author. One who writes and sells books, but one who has never had that huge book that sold millions of copies and sends you to shop windows. How does that feel? What's it like to keep carrying on when it's such a tough publishing world out there? We go through all of it with Caroline Dunford, and we pick things up as we always do with what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
I've got a big screen in front of me. I'm sitting with my face to the wall, which is full of books. And I have got screens on my left and my right as well. I have books all across my desk. I have a laptop. I have nail varnish, my drink and charging stations, box of pens and bits of papers with notes on them. Oh, and even a pair of earrings. I live at my desk.
Well, it does sound busy. It sounds curated, like you know exactly what it is that you need around you to write. I'm thinking of almost like a pilot sat in the chair with all the instruments and the levers around them. Now, you've published over 30 books, right? So it's a lot of time writing. How along that way, how much have you learned about what it is that you do actually need to write?
An enormous amount, to be honest. I think the most important thing that I've learned is that I always used to tell stories and write stories and make up stories. It's something in my nature. And that includes right from primary school when I used to write plays for everybody else to join in. And I now teach writing to a certain extent. But the thing that I really discovered is what can't be taught and what can't be manufactured in any way is that desire to write. If I don't write, I get unreasonable, I get grumpy, I'm not comfortable in the world to the extent that people in my family will say, "Have you done any writing today?" So for me, the most important thing is you have that drive. You can have ideas, you can have craft, but there needs to be something fundamentally wrong with you that makes you want to write. I guess I think my writing is all about making sense of the world around me, which is a very confusing place.
Where do you think that comes from then? As you say, you can't teach having that just inbuilt desire, that need to write. I speak to a lot of authors, and I would say perhaps some don't have it anywhere near as strongly as you do. Just looking over how many books you've written over so many different genres and so many different forms of media, right? There is this strong desire just to get stuff down. Where does that come from?
I think that's a really interesting question. And it's not an easy one to answer. I mean, you could regard it as an infection, I suppose, and that I have it worse than most people. But I mean, more seriously, it is about me making sense of the world around me. And there's a lot of things in the world that I think, well, we all don't like, or we all wish were different. As an individual, I don't necessarily have any power to change any of the things I don't like. I don't have lots of money. Well, I'm a writer. Of course, I don't have lots of money. So what I can do, and probably this is a big part of what drives me, is ask questions within my stories to reflect back what I see in the world and in society around me. I'm not giving people answers because I don't have the answers, but there are sometimes things that just don't make sense to me. And I suppose those are buried in my stories. Those are themes within my stories that I hope other people will look at. So it's a desire, I suppose, just to just to ask why is the underlying pushing thing. Why do people do certain things? Why does the world work in a certain way? Why don't people say things? Why do people pretend that life goes on forever? I mean, in the sense that they don't think about their own demise or the demise of others, all those kind of things. And I think that's what I'm trying to unwrap when I'm writing, partly for myself and partly for my readers. Yeah.
It's easy when you're an adult to rationalize it like that. When you are much younger, you're not able to do that. Have you always felt this need to write? I mean, a lot of kids will just write in their spare time, you know, imagine stories. Was it even stronger and more frequently for you?
It was the first memories I have are of writing or telling stories. And I think as a child, it was about just making sense of the world and sort of checking out, is this how the world works? I mean, we all are a collection of stories, aren't we? Because we're all made up of our memories, and our memories are sort of put together, concertinaed versions of our experience. We cherry pick bits and pieces. And every time we look at our memories, we look through the lens of our experience to date. So our stories are constantly evolving. And I've always thought of the world and people like that as stories that interact. I think it's just a particular way, I think, partly. And I think there's also something in there about the fact it was fun. I mean, when I was really small, making stories was fun. And also when I told stories, I was popular. People wanted to hear the stories. I wasn't that popular otherwise. But if there was a story to be told in the classroom or in the playground, people used to say, in primary school even, get Caroline to tell the story. And that was nice. So I got lots of positive reinforcement from it as well. And that's probably why it became more and more a part of me.
And you've worked yourself into a position where you can tell stories and make something of a living out of it, as you said earlier. I know that you do an awful lot. At what point do you remember, like, thinking so seriously about telling stories that you learn how to do it properly, that you kind of sat there and thought, oh, how do other authors do it? How's the best way to plan a story? What act structure do stories need? How forceful was that thought for you?
I think it was something that definitely evolved over time. First of all, when I first started writing, I wrote short stories. I used to write, I'm not going to tell you how long ago it was. It was a while ago. I read lots of short stories magazines and I enjoyed short stories. So I thought I'd write, I would actually try to get professionally published. And when I wanted to get professionally published, I started looking at short stories and thinking about how they were put together. But I don't think I really knew very much then. And then when one of my sons was very young, I got a contract to write a book about basically a narrative diary about what it was like living with a two-year-old, because it's kind of all-consuming. And I wrote sort of like information panels because I've been a journalist. So I'd been through journalism school, which gives you a perspective on how to write. But then when I started writing the narrative tale and realized what needed to be included and didn't need to be included, I think that was a big change for me. So it was a certain amount of learning through experience. Although being taught how to do journalism, I find a lot of authors have been journalists at some time in their life. Because journalism training is very exact as to what you put in, where you put it in, so that when you come to fiction, it's something of a relief. So I definitely started thinking there. And I decided that one of my weakest things when I was first starting out was my dialogue wasn't always that convincing. So I went to workshops by some fairly famous Scottish playwrights there, Douglas Maxwell, for example, just to learn how to write better dialogue. And I discovered that I actually could write plays. I thought I didn't have any idea how to structure a play. I mean, I'd done them when I was a child, but as an adult, I didn't. And I discovered that it's a very different process, that I could write plays. And then I think I started thinking much more in terms of acts and investigating acts and thinking about those kind of points of total commitment, point of no return, when you need to do reversals, when you need to focus your story and recap it. And I do approach it differently depending on what I'm writing. Some of my longer running stories, it kind of comes quite naturally because I know them so well. But when I'm writing newer things, like as Gemini Gibson writing The Augmenters, it was very much me concentrating on how I unfolded the story and where were the major points I was going to use. And then I was getting between the major points and constantly trying to raise the stakes. That's a very long answer.
No. You mentioned like when you first started and learning that you maybe weren't so hot on dialogue. How much are you still analysing what you do and thinking, oh, I can get better at this? And then if there is something that you feel you can get better at, how are you doing that now? What are you turning to help and to teach how to get better on, like, very niche specific parts of the craft, because you've been doing it for so long?
Okay, I think you're always getting better, is the answer. I think you're always improving. Until I write the perfect novel that sells in multi-millions, which I almost certainly will never do, well, it certainly won't be perfect, you are always working to refine your craft and to refine your voice. I think there's a certain amount of confidence that comes with publication that allows you to fall more strongly into the voice of the characters that you're writing. I mean, you said I write across a lot of different genres, and people are sometimes surprised at the different tones or the different voices that I use. And I think writing plays, just falling into different characters and being able to write different characters, I think a lot of it does come from dialogue for me. And also from building up essentially a profile of that character and knowing why they are doing what they are doing. If I'm doing, I'm still looking to improve things I know I have to improve. I still look at Shrunk and White like everybody does at the start, because I'm very good at kind of scattering commas across a page. Every time I stop when I'm writing, I stick in a comma. I know that I have to work on that. I also have to constantly tell myself not to use semicolons and colons, because I'm not writing, I suppose, what you call literary fiction. I need to make it. I stop and I think about how punchy a story is. I constantly think about how does this scene own its part in the story? How does it earn that it should be there? Is it just a nice scene I've written because I like the characters doing something? Or is it a case of I need to do something different because I need to carry the story forward, or I need to take that out? I also spend a lot of time thinking about language and rereading things, looking over my language, thinking about whether or not I'm using contractions, or also whether the language I use. I love words. I love weird words. I love amazing words. And they're not always the ones that you need to put in the story, because they aren't necessarily what people need to hear. They need to have a story that gives them sense, all the senses, and it gives them emotion. It doesn't need to send them to the dictionary. So that's something that, I mean, I really like really obscure words. So it doesn't need to do that. So I watch for that. I teach, as you know, part-time at Edinburgh University. I teach creative writing in continued ongoing learning, COL. And when I'm there, I actually think I learn a lot from my students. I have all these techniques because I tell them right from the start that I'm just teaching them craft. I can help them relax and imagine things more. I can give them sort of springboards, but I can't give them the desire to write. I can definitely teach craft. And sometimes the way people approach things just blows me away. It gives me an entirely different idea. And also equally, sometimes when people do things that don't work, it's really refreshing to be able to say to somebody, this doesn't work because you have, you've written this extra piece because you needed to know it. For example, students love writing prologues. And a prologue is normally, not always, but normally just you setting out the background details of your world. and everything in it generally needs to, should naturally come through the story. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And you speak about kind of learning how to write genre and some of the rules. I mean, you were talking about ways of laying out your sentence, and because it's not literary, I always struggle with that word. Because
it's a horrible word.
Literary fiction. Because it's not literary fiction. Your sentences perhaps need to be in a slightly different...
Yes, they
have. Yeah, in a slightly different mould. I guess, so you've written, what is it, in the... is it 16 books in your Euphemia Martins mysteries?
17 now.
So there are 17 books in that series set in the past. So, and at what point, kind of writing those 17, do you feel you got the voice? How long did it take you to understand the tone of what these needed to be, to understand the rules of the genre you were writing in?
Okay, if I'm perfectly honest, book 9 is where it really takes off. I would say the books before are competent. They tell a reasonable story. But book 9, which is A Death, the King and Country, is where I really feel that I got a proper handle on the series. So that's a big confession. There are 8 books that are good and entertaining. She says, try not to put readers off. But it's book 9 that it really comes into its own, I think.
How did you know that at the time? Do you remember feeling during book 9? Oh, you know, this is something a bit different. Maybe I've figured something out now.
No, I didn't realise. I just read it again a book or so later on and realised that it was very distinctly different. It was also a longer form because the books to start with started off at like 50,000 words. And this is when it starts moving to the longer form and I had more space. And usually you're trying to cut things in stories to make them crisper. But because I wanted to go so in depth with the characters and it was about continuing characters and there's a huge cast. You don't see them all the time, but different people pop up again and again along with the main sort of protagonist. That was the one. And when I look back at it and I read it and I thought, okay, sounds immodest, but I thought, this isn't half bad. Where the other ones were sort of like, yeah, that's okay. But this was, ooh. So it was really going back and reading it again and thinking, in some parts of it, I was looking at it and thinking, did I really write that? I suppose, in other words, when I was actually writing it, I was so in the story. I planned the story. I knew what was going on. I think for me, I have to, if I'm doing any kind of mystery, I knew what was going to happen. But I had really disappeared into the book and into the story so that I wasn't as aware of what I was actually writing. That sounds like a strange thing to say. There's a lovely book called Zen and the Art of Writing by Ray Bradbury. And he talks about it, writing his first decent story and knowing that he'd written his first decent story because at the end of it, he had sweat dripping off his nose and he was so emotional and he's just so connected with it. And I think that's what happened with me in that book, maybe not to the same extent because I wasn't doing anything quite as strong as maybe one of his stories might have been. But yeah, it's that you realise that when you've been writing, you have just been in that world.
How much is the knowledge of that and the memory of that time and rereading it and discovering it was something different, how much has that stayed with you and influenced how you work on things ever since, knowing that you can do something like that and it was quite alien to what had come before?
It's made me realise that the only things I will write are stories where I am totally in love with the characters and where I really want to be in that journey with them. I don't mean as a writer. I mean, if I could, I would step into that book and be doing whatever they're doing alongside them. It's made me, I used to get touches of that in earlier on in stories where there were bits where I really felt immersed. But now, I have to feel, I know that I I recognize that feeling of excitement and the feeling that, you know, several hours will go by and it'll be like 10 minutes. I've just been writing away. So for me, I suppose this is also very relevant. I need to think. I might wander around for a day or 2 days looking as if I'm doing nothing. Then I'll write, I maybe write a few notes. And then the next day, I might churn out 10,000 words. And of course, I'll go over it and I'll edit it. But the majority of those words will be used. So I do a kind of internal processing before I actually commit to the page. Well, the typewriter. Not the typewriter. The keyboard. Usually, I wake up in bed. I do the terrible thing of reading my email in bed. Then I will get out a notebook and I will note down all the scenes I'm thinking or hoping to write that day. Now, this is always a wish list rather than necessarily a reality, because sometimes when I come to write, I find that I now allow a little bit of organic growth. I don't go off at a massive tangent, but there might be little extra scenes, or I might decide that one of the scenes I wanted to write isn't going to be necessary. Then usually my poor partner makes some kind of breakfast. If it's a really strong writing day for me, I'll eat something, I'll sit down and I'll write for maybe 2.5 or so hours before I need to stop for coffee, if my sons haven't just been coming up and giving me cups of coffee in an attempt to keep me quiet and out of their hair if they're at home. I'll have lunch. I will work into the afternoon as well. So I'm doing, this is a very heavy writing day. I will try and do something sociable in the late afternoon, early evening. So that might be just playing a game with the family or reading a book or going out for a coffee. And then I tell myself that I will have dinner, I'll watch a bit of TV and I'll go to bed. And the reality is that I have dinner. I either find a story that really interests me and I watch far too many episodes and go to bed very late, or I have dinner and I go back and I write some more. So that's a really strong writing day for me.
How you said that, that is a writing day, which implies that there are some days that aren't writing days. Like, how often do you get that dream day, the really strong ones?
It goes by season, and it goes also depends on contract. I would say when I'm at the moment slightly late on delivering a book, I am doing writing days every day apart from Wednesdays and Thursdays when I'm working for the university. That includes weekends. I'm not usually late with anything. There's just been a series of life events that have made that slightly more difficult. So I would say in normal circumstances, I try to write Monday, Tuesdays and Fridays. And I'm always very bad at taking weekend days off. So sometimes I work then as well. But when I say writing days, I think this is what you're going to ask me next, actually. Some of those days, if I'm planning a book, will be research days, because I do a lot of research before I actually start writing.
Are you bothered when you work weekends?
I'm trying not to, because it doesn't make me a very, you know, I think I used to have friends. And I remember the names of most of the people that live in the same house. But, you know, you can get so absorbed in your writing that you can just kind of withdraw into this little hermit world. And then I go out and see my students a couple of days a week and I talk to them. And I thought, oh, well, that's my interaction with the rest of the world, back into my world. And I'm not sure how healthy that is, because apart from anything else, I think, and though I'm not really doing it right now, but I think the best writers are people who actually also experience life, who go out and talk to people and mix with people and look at what's going on in the world, use their writing, as I usually try to do, as a mirror.
You said earlier about the 10,000 word days.
I can, yeah. Those are really heavy days. I mean, at the end of a 10,000 word day, my brain is mush.
What are you normally working to?
4,000 is comfortable.
See, that's still quite a lot, isn't it?
I think I think that's just down to me. I think it is quite a lot. I've read that some authors write that, and then I read that some authors write, 700 words a day, and maybe their 700 words a day are better than my 4,000. I don't know. But 4,000 is a comfortable one for me.
And through the year, writing all these words and flitting about between genre, are you always able to kind of keep that energy up? Does this desire to tell stories and write completely outweigh any feeling of, burnout that you might get?
I think stories save me from burnout, to be honest. Sometimes, yes, obviously I sort of say, right, I'm not going to write for 2 weeks, we'll have a staycation. It's been more recently because of the pandemic. But by the end of those 2 weeks, I'm clawing, trying to get back to the keyboard. I don't think writing brings me burnout. I think there are other things of life that I can find quite exhausting, and writing, if anything, is my saviour there. I have more stories to tell than I expect I will ever have time to tell. I don't have any shortage of things I want to do. Of course, now I do talk to Amy, my agent, and she says, well, maybe people would like to hear that story more than this story. So not that all the ideas I ever have come to fruition, but writing is my safe place. Writing is my re-energizing space.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One of Scotland's most notorious unsolved murders.
I was the first scientist to open up these items that had been stored by the police since the time of the crime.
And it's always been in my mind for over 40 years that I could have found the guy responsible.
I firmly believe that somebody out there knows something.
Who is the Cheesewire Killer? Listen to the full series now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, and this week we are sponsored by that new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheesewire Killer? Have a listen. You can be in the heart of this live investigation. The full series is there for you to listen to and binge through. Just search Who is the Cheesewire Killer wherever you get your shows. And you can support the podcast as well. You can sponsor us if you like by pledging over on our Patreon page. Become a backer, patreon.com/writersroutine. For just a few dollars a month, it helps us carry on. It helps us keep bringing you these chats with the best authors around. Such wide, varied authors too. For that, you get merch. There is bonus content. There is even a way for your book to sponsor this show. So if you've put something out there, if it has not got the plugging that you think it absolutely does, so do I, well, let me do it for you. To make that happen, become a backer, support the show, and help this carry on. Get to patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it then with Caroline Dunford, busy, busy, busy author, writing 3 books a year normally. She's published over 30. Her newest one is The Augmenters, which she's released under the name Gemini Gibson. We'll talk all about that. You can also hear what happens when readers love a character more than you expected. Also, how she figures out the tone of a book and the voice of it when she's flitting between genres. And we get back into it talking about how, with so many ideas in her head, how does she know what she's writing next?
The Euphemia and the Hope stories, as opposed to the World War stories, the World War One and World War Two, they are contracted, and they're contracted in sort of blocks. So they're sort of ongoing. And while they're ongoing, that's something I'm just doing. When it comes to the Augmenters, I had written the Augmenters on a whim, and I showed it to Amy, and she loved it. We did a couple of little changes, and then it was there. Currently, I can't tell you what it is, but I have another genre book out on submission at the moment. And that book came out of Amy and I sitting and talking online, because she's in America. And we were just chatting away, because we are also quite good friends. We are good friends. And she said, oh, that would be crazy, wouldn't it, if you wrote a book about this? And I said, well, if I was going to write about this, I'd do this, this, and this. And she just jumped up and down in excitement and squeaked. so I wrote it. So sometimes it comes out of what we think we can sell, because the reality is that if you want your books to be read by others, you have to be able to find a way into the market. And she knows a lot more about that than me. The Euphemia books and the Hope books are dictated by the faces of the war and the original story arcs that I thought of for the characters and where I thought I would leave them. So what I did very much with the Euphemia ones was I did one book that was very much about what was happening in the characters' lives, and then I do one book, same characters, but something that was happening historically that was very important that they got caught up with. Although I will say, I always get them caught up peripherally. My characters are always making a difference in the world, but they're the people you don't normally see, the people behind the scenes, because the others so frequently turn up in fiction that I just wanted to do something different.
It is interesting that you write under contract, yet you mentioned writing the Augmenters and how you had kind of written that without a contract, right? You were just doing that in your spare time, and then you showed it to your agent. As I say, I've spoken to a lot of authors, and I don't think a lot of them would take that view of it. I think sometimes it's, well, I ain't writing if I ain't getting the money at times.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? It's a funny business, publishing. It's constantly changing, and I don't think it's the most, what would be the good word to use? Transparent, egalitarian, straightforward industry. So, yes, I mean, I work part-time, so I don't depend solely. I used to depend solely when I was first writing Euphemia books, but I don't anymore depend solely on my writing. And also, with Amy, we've been talking about writing a book that might get me more attention, which is, you know, you always hope the next book's going to be the one that really takes off. And it's very hard at the moment to do that. I'm sure a lot of your other authors have mentioned the celebrity cult, which has been, and there's nothing wrong with celebrities writing, obviously not, but you know, when you get celebrity writers in the crime section, for example, it tends to wash everybody else away. Because people just go for names they know. And with ebooks as well, so many people can self-publish. There is so much material out there, it's hard to get attention. So sometimes you just write something that you feel passionate about, if you have the time, and you give it to your agent. Well, I give it to my agent and say, can we do something with this? Because I was really passionate about this story, and I put my heart and soul in it. And every time I've done that, which is only the Augmenters and the other one, which we don't know about yet, we've got a lot of interest. So, yeah, risky.
Your novels, I mean, you've sold novels, right? But I mean, as you said, you're waiting for that book that is really going to take hold. And earlier you mentioned like the multi-million copy bestseller. How do you feel like having published so many novels, yet you've never quite had that one that has absolutely gone gangbusters, completely blown up just yet?
Yeah. I suppose I feel a bit like Van Gogh felt.
That's a big comparison to make.
I know, isn't it? It's a really cheeky comparison to make. But I don't necessarily think I'm a genius. Everybody likes to think they're a very good writer. I think I am a good writer, but you know, I fear I may be discovered after my lifetime. I just think the market's got harder and harder. And that is one of the few things that can make me quite depressed when you think it's not that when I do get reviews, generally my reviews are really good, but it's always reaching the public. And unless you have a huge amount of money to throw at, you know, displays in all the Waterstones in the country or whatever, it's hard to get that traction. Sometimes people do. And, you know, I think that's great. But, you usually get as much traction as your publisher puts money into your books, and publishers put money into books they are absolutely sure are going to succeed. And the book with a famous name on the front is always going to succeed because people will buy it to see what it's like. So that's what you're competing against. It's a bit depressing, but I still hope. I'll often hand a book in around about February, as in this one that's slightly late. As soon as I hand the book in, I become really depressed. Some people celebrate, but I tend to feel it's gone, and I feel really deflated that what I was doing and enjoying is gone. And it usually takes me a couple of weeks to get out of that. Then I will start planning. I will look at how long before the book has to be delivered, and I will plot the novel in a notebook by hand. But when I say plot, you know, it's untidy notes. Compared to, you know, some people do beautiful notes and very clever plans and use Scrivener or whatever. That's not my process. So if I handed in a book in February, by the end of the next month, I will have planned my next novel, and I will have divided up and given myself how many words I need to make a day to get it into its contract. So if I say I was writing for... I usually only do one book at a time. So say I was writing over the next 3 months, it would be for that book. So you're looking at every quarter, a period of maybe a month planning and three months writing and delivering.
So those three months, well, I guess two questions, that month plotting and researching, how streamlined is that process now? Do you kind of immediately know, okay, here's what I want to do, here's what I want to look up? If you're diving into a new genre, are you completely aware of how you're spending those days, or is it a bit of a teenager kind of doing homework, not really sure of what's happening?
I think it's probably halfway in between, because there'll be certain things that I definitely want to research, and I know I want to research. I have, for example, I'm writing one of the Hope novels at the moment, and I'm writing about the Blitz. So I needed to know, well, obviously when the Blitz happened, but apart from that, I needed to look at what the bombs were that fell during that time, what areas of London they fell in, various things about how emergency and rescue services operated, and just the locations and how people managed. It was actually, I'm not going to go into huge detail because it was all a bit depressing, and some of it was really quite challenging to write. So there will be those kind of things that I know I want to know. And then there will be the odd little thing that comes up during my research that I follow, and I try not to go down too many rabbit holes, that will give me an extra idea. So for example, I was looking at this and one of the background characters needed to be involved, and they needed to be in the Ministry of Information. And I was trying to think about what they could be put in. And it was meant to be partly funny as well, because this person is naturally probably an engineer more than anything, although they haven't had the chance to do very much of that. So I put them into what was known as MO, the mass observation. So they were actually collating all the mass observations, all the diaries that were collected. And their spelling isn't even that great, and they're having to read all of these reports and file them. But I came across MO, which is fascinating, the Mass Observation Project, absolutely fascinating in itself. And there's lots of stories within it about what happened in the Blitz. but that was a kind of a little treat that I found on the side. So I was concentrating more on the hardcore stuff, and I found an extra detail that I could incorporate. I thought, right, that will work. So I start out with things I absolutely need to know, that I know I need to know for the story. And I look for background details. I look for interesting little other bits that come up at the time. But the thing is, I've been writing from the First and Second World War books now for such a long time that I have read a lot. And sometimes it's a case of when I'm reading, I will also be making notes saying, oh, well, this will go in book number whatever in the future. So, again, that's a slightly organic process.
Well, just mentioning the wartime books, and I'm looking here, so you've got in the Euphemia Martins and Hope, so 17 books, and so there's a death in the family, there's a death in the Highlands, a death in the asylum, a death in the pavilion, a death in the lock. My personal favourite title is a death in the gentleman's club. So I really enjoy, and idea generation can't be as simple as this, so I apologise for making it out like it. But what's it like? And the question, by the way, is not as try as where do you get your ideas from, but it seems like you've got these characters to a point now where you can kind of plonk them in places and they find a dead body and chaos ensues and you've got a story. Tell me it's harder than that.
Yeah, it is a bit harder than that, because in the Euphemia novels, the Euphemia is based on my great-grandmother, she was the one that gave me the idea. And this is something I haven't mentioned to you. I woke up one morning and thought I should write a story about my great grandmother. The family legend is that her mother died and her father remarried. She was very wealthy. Her family were very wealthy, and she couldn't stand her stepmother. And she said to her father, essentially, she gave him an ultimatum, and he returned it and said, "It's, you know, if you don't get on with your stepmother, you can leave." And so she left. And the only things that were open to women at that time were working as a servant or prostitution. And she chose to work as a servant. Her story at that point deviates from Euphemia's, because Euphemia goes on to become, at first, a sort of amateur detective and eventually an agent of the Crown. But along that story is where Euphemia came from, why she's in the position that she's in, and secrets that she doesn't know about her own life, which gradually unfold. The relationships that she goes through, the people that she gets romantically involved with but doesn't quite marry until she does marry, and then that's still really not her final destination, where she's going to end up, because you see her again as a background character in the Hope novels. And the Hope novels are much more espionage. They're all about counterterrorism rather than there are dead bodies, because I've tried to write novels without dead bodies and they always show up. I can't. There's something about, you know, the facing of mortality and being in a crisis situation that strips away what all the facades that people have and really shows you the sort of the core of what someone's like. And that doesn't have to be a good core, but it's kind of like the essence of humanity without the veneers. So I think that's why I keep dropping dead bodies into things. But Euphemia's stories are all, you know, it's nice that you love a death in a gentleman's club, but that story is, actually a payoff for fans that have read it, with while there is a murder mystery in it, there's also the fact we find out about her father, what her father was doing historically, and we find out that somebody has been manipulating her life for quite a long time. So there are the characters all have their own arcs and their own stories, and the murders and the things they come across are interwoven. And I hope they don't come across as, you know, if this character appears, there's a dead body and actually they're a secret serial killer. Like, you wonder about Miss Marple from time to time. There are reasons why they find bodies. she becomes an agent of the Crown. And again, it's World War One, they were it was much more free ranging. But a lot of things is she's given those kind of things to investigate, or she's tasked with seeing that someone is assassinated. Even she doesn't. She tends to find a different way around. But that there are, in these particular stories, that there are long stories. And you can read all the books individually, but people who are fans really like the books where there's a certain amount of payoff. And in fact, there was one walk-on character who was never meant to be that important, who's called Fitzroy, who is an agent of the Crown in the Euphemia books and in the Hope books, because in my contract it says I must now include him because he had such a popular response. And for the last couple of years, I have been writing a weekly diary, non-chronological for him. I haven't done it this year, but I think I'm going to start doing it again fairly shortly. So this is something else that appears in the background and it is in itself, I think, a couple of 100,000 words long, but each story is not particularly long, but it's all about the character.
Oh, that's interesting that it's in your contract now that Fitzroy has to be in it. And I mean, you are a, you know, you're a working writer and you understand that these are the way that things are. But how is it sometimes when maybe you're writing organically, but you know that you've got to have this guy in it?
Well, he's become such a big character. It's fine. I'm very fond of him. I was surprised when it turned up in my contract. When it turned up in the contract, it said, for these ones, you will include Euphemia, you will include Fitzroy. And sort of like, well, okay. I was probably going to do that anyway, but it was just a sign that he was so popular. And it's funny how people respond to your books, as you're right. They take on a life of their own. And part of that is maybe something that's bubbling up through your unconscious and you're putting out there. And part of it is a response. And if you've got fans, you've got an audience who say, we really enjoyed this and you like it too, then you want to tell them more stories about what they really enjoy. Win-win.
When you are writing a series of stories that goes on, well, 17 novels and I imagine counting at the moment, and you've got all these characters interweaving and it's a big kind of universe that you've made with this, how far into the future are you thinking? How much do you know about what people will be doing in one, two, or even three books' time?
Well, I do kill them off along the way, so they don't all remain. You can be fairly assured usually that the central characters survive, but I have killed off some people people didn't expect. And by the time the second series comes around, some of the really significant characters are gone. I think I know the destination for all of the characters, for all of the main characters, the reoccurring characters. Whether or not those stories will ever come out in print is another matter, because, I mean, how far can you take a series before people get bored? That's always a question for me. I don't know how long the series will go on. That's partly the publisher's decision. I know where they all end up and what happens to them, but whether those stories get told, I don't know.
When you are maybe dipping your toe into a genre that you've not worked on before, but say the first time you do maybe something a bit more romantic, or maybe the first time that you wrote YA, what tricks have you learned that help you quite quickly get to grips with what this genre is all about, the tone and the voice, as you spoke earlier? Is there anything you do?
I think one of the things is I try to take a really hard look at who I think my audience is going to be and how I can best communicate with them. One of the young adult novels I wrote is about cybercrime, but more importantly, it's about children grooming other children to do crime things, and whether it is possible to get out of a very deprived situation and get yourself another life. And that book is, well, it's so full of swear words that I would hesitate to show it to some of my friends. But it was me looking at how people spoke, how those kids spoke to each other, and doing research and thinking about what would connect with them, what would become realistic. And you have to be careful not to use, trendy words of the time. But that is a very hard-hitting book that is full of really gritty details and swear words, and tries to show how hard some people's lives can be. Another YA I wrote, which is Fake News, which is all about how some children young people decide to take over, to create a website in which they will put the most fantastic stories to see if they can get people to believe them, because they have all been injured by gossip on the web, and they want to show people that you shouldn't trust what turns up on the internet. That book's funny. It has a dog in it. The Euphemia books have a dog in them now as well. It has a dog in it, and probably those kids are all from a fairly middle-class background, so they speak differently. And it's quite funny in places, and then it's quite tragic in others. And there's different issues that they have to deal with. One of the things that they look at a lot one of the big things that's looked at in that book is the issue of defining yourself, and how you might define yourself by genre, not genre, by gender, and whether or not you have to commit to certain things, and how you accept or don't accept difference. That's a big, big thing about difference in Fake News. In Snared, it's much more about how do you survive? How do you get out of a desperate situation where nobody is going to support you? So those are very different stories. They require a very different voice. So it kind of all ties up together. Euphemia is, I suppose, she's very well educated. So she speaks in a almost Victorian manner, not quite, but almost. And people tell me that's how I speak. So Euphemia is easy. Writing Snared was hard. Writing The Augmenters was different. It was much more of a sort of adventurous story in a fantasy adventure in the steampunk world. And that required a different approach as well. Am I being at all clear?
Yes, I think so. And my last question is all about The Augmenters, actually, because this is your most recent book that you've published, albeit under a different name. And you wrote this just for your, without contract, without anything like this. You were just writing for writing. What was it about this story that really meant it had to be told for you? You've got a lot of projects, and you discussed working on them with your agent and thinking, maybe we should do this one right now. What was it about this one that meant it had to be told?
Well, The Augmenters became suddenly much more of the moment, because within it is the story about how much you sacrifice your humanity to using machinery. But at the heart of it, it's a story about people trying to defeat a class and a political system. Two young people trying to defeat a class and a political system that is very abusive towards lots of different people. And I think it's just a protest against how societies can go, how societies can not be equal and open and give opportunity to everyone. So that's the theme. That's the protest. The excitement comes from the fact that it's told from the point of view of somebody who gets caught up with underground gangs and rebellions, and people telling us with secrets, and who has to try and figure out where the truth is, and or not even where the truth is, because it does truth exist? What is the right thing to do? And there's also all these mechanical marvels, and there's this amazing sky locomotive that can travel across the world in hardly any time, and they need to find out how that can be possible. And there's romance, and there's betrayal, and there's mechanical soldiers, and there's horrible little things that that can be fired, like look like little golden bugs that can kill people. And there's all kinds of, you know, exotic things around it. It was great fun to write and create, but it's really a protest. The whole book is a protest about why can't things be fairer.
And that's it for this week's episode of Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Caroline Dunford for being on the show. So many books that you can enjoy, like 17 in the Euphemia Martins Mysteries. The new one is The Augmenters. That is out as Gemini Gibson right now. We are back next week with a brand new episode. In the meantime, you can support us, patreon.com/writersroutine. We are sponsored this week by the new True Crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? Search, have a listen, wherever you get your shows from. You can get in touch with the podcast too at writersroutine.com, and we are on X at writerspod. And we've got a YouTube channel as well. If that's your preferred way of listening to these things, get over to YouTube, find Writer's Routine on there. We've got all the links on our X page, and we're even on YouTube podcasts. You can find our episodes there. And I will see you next week with a brand new guest on the show. Until then, bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.